Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today we are joined by John, debater of atheists, defender of the Catholic Christian worldview, John Deuteronomy himself. Ladies and gentlemen, John DeRosa.
Jake Buscher, thank you so much again for having me on the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. I know I can never predict the introductions, but they are always phenomenal.
They get more wild every time somebody comes on the podcast. I think I shocked Pat Flynn a little bit too much by comparing him to Michael Jackson in one of the earlier episodes. Yeah, his reaction was a bit unsettling. I'm like, I really hope I didn't offend him somehow. I like Michael, but I understand the scandals. But anyways, without any further ado, we're going to keep this pretty punchy and quick. You had a recent debate with a very friendly atheist fellow who you talked to before. I thought it went fantastic. You gave it your performance a B minus, but unfortunately, John, you're wrong. It wasn't. It was awesome. And other people who've heard it had similar reports. So I invite everybody to pause right here, listen to the debate, and great, you're back. Let's talk about it, John. The first thing I want to bring up is, of course, the classic question. Who has the burden of proof? So how did you decide who had the burden of proof, and why is that important in the real world?
Yes, I'll explain that. And actually, I think in doing so, is it all right if I explain a little bit more about how this debate came about?
Sure, of course.
Okay. And I know you said to pause and go listen to the debate, but I realize people have busy lives and maybe not everybody had a chance to do that. So I'll try to catch you up to speed on what the debate was about, even if you didn't have a chance to listen to the full thing yet.
Very
long. Okay, thank you. Well, long story short, people know that there are various kinds of difficulties people bring up with respect to the Bible. And atheists like to raise different difficulties to cast doubt on the fact that the Bible is the Word of God. And they can raise difficulties with respect to the New Testament, and they can raise difficulties with respect to the Old Testament. And on my podcast, probably about a year ago at this point, I interviewed Jimmy Akin about his course over at the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics on Bible difficulties. And we discussed some New Testament and some Old Testament difficulties. And in particular, we looked at a passage in Deuteronomy, which have come to be known as the captive bride verses, which discuss how Israelites are to treat women in armies that they've conquered or in peoples that they've conquered, how they are to treat them if they see among those conquered people a beautiful woman that they want to marry, and how this is supposed to go down. Long story short, Jimmy Akin gave some interpretation of that. This atheist that I've dialogued with a couple of times, Dana Harper, who has been a very respectful and friendly gentleman in all of our conversations, emailed me and said, you know, he disagreed with Jimmy Akin's interpretation of that passage. He gave me his own interpretation, and he asked if I would be willing to have him on the show to dialogue about this issue. So the passage under debate is Deuteronomy 21, verses 10 to 14, and it describes what happens when Israel goes out to war against their enemies, and they see among the captives, I'm just reading here from verse 11 onward, a beautiful woman, desire to take her to be your wife. What should you do? It says in verses 12 through 14, you bring her into your house, she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall take off the clothes in which she was captured, and she shall remain in your house and lament her father and mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. Verse 14, but if you no longer delight in her, you shall let her go where she wants. But you shall not sell her for money, nor shall you treat her as a slave, since you have humiliated her. End quote. So again, that's Deuteronomy 21, verses 10 through 14. So in this debate, the resolution was that these verses are immoral and uninspired. That was the resolution of the debate. So you'll notice the way it's phrased, that these are immoral verses, or these are immorality sanctioned in the Bible, and that they are not inspired by God. The way that's phrased is something an atheist might affirm. And in fact, this atheist, Dana Harper, who I've dialogued with, does affirm that. So he's taking the affirmative position, which he volunteered to do, which means that he's shouldering a burden of proof that he has to demonstrate that these passages are immoral and that they are not inspired by God. So that meant in the context of the debate, I took the negative position. I really just had to show that his case didn't fully go through. I had to explain or give a rationale for why these verses were not immoral. And since the main reason he gave for thinking that the passage was uninspired is that it sanctioned something that's so blatantly grotesque and immoral, and that's why it can't be inspired by a holy and all good God. Because that was his main reason for showing why it can't be inspired, I didn't have to prove that the text is inspired. I could just say, according to our Catholic Christian worldview, I hold that the Bible is inspired, and I can answer his argument and say and give a rationale for why these verses are not immoral and they don't sanction what he declared to be grotesque moral actions. So that was kind of the situation in this debate. And I was actually quite pleased that the atheist was willing to shoulder the burden of proof. And it was an interesting debate. We had a lot of discussion. Ultimately, I don't think he was able to make his case go through. However, there was a very sticky point that we'll kind of get to right in the beginning regarding how we defined our terms. And Dana Harper actually argued that this text sanctioned rape and was God's approval of rape in the Old Testament.
Right. That seemed to be really the hinge of the discussion, where if we can settle that one side or the other, I think that definitively pushes either you or him as the winner. So yeah, okay, keep opening that.
Well, let me just say that to open that door further, and I want to get your thoughts of how you kind of position this in your mind, having heard the debate and inviting me for this debrief. I wanted to hear some of your thoughts as well, Jake, because you have a lot to say, and I like your series on Leviticus and the Old Testament. It's super, super interesting. But essentially, Dane Harper was saying this passage sanctioned rape, and then I was saying, no, it doesn't. And so then we were kind of getting into the text and analyzing the situation. He brought up the fact that the text doesn't explicitly mention that a woman has to consent to this among the conquered people. And then I brought up the fact, yes, but it also doesn't mention her lack of consent. It says that if the Israelite warrior wants to be with one of these women, he can't just take her and do whatever he wants with her. The text doesn't say that. Instead, it describes a ritual for how he has to marry her. And so I took that to exclude the notion of rape, but he was pushing hard that no, he didn't see that angle on it. I'm curious, Jake, what you thought of that part of the debate and some other things you might have pointed to with respect to the burden of proof as to whether this sanctioned rape or not.
Right. Oh, I have a number of thoughts. First, he seemed to say that it was non-consensual because of her very poor circumstance, where her city has been destroyed, her husband may have been killed in battle, therefore she can't consent. The problem I have with that point is that with that logic, we could say that, say, women in Somalia today, where there's a breakdown of rule of law, can't get married, or really poor women in the slums of India who are bare subsistence level, and a husband says, well, I could support you better, can't consent. We would be blocking off women from consenting to leave terrible circumstances. That seems like the opposite of their interest, and that seems like too high of a bar for consent. I think that consent would be if there's a threat of violence, but there's not. There's actually the very opposite. Instead, this husband is coming in and giving in not a threat of violence. Instead, he's giving an offer to come into a peaceful community. So I think that one, I have a couple points, so I'll rattle on a few. Another one is, I think that he assumed a cultural approval of rape. But if we look just back in, I believe it's Genesis, with the rape of Dinah, one of the daughters of Jacob, clearly this was not a culture that was positive, rape positive. Goodness gracious.
Yes, her actually, brothers. And I want to let you continue that point, Jake. I just want to say this is one of the reasons I gave myself that B minus, is I don't think I made this point strong enough. What other evidence is there in the Torah that it's not culturally accepted to rape a woman? And you're giving one piece of evidence. I'd love you to keep going.
They literally slaughtered a city, the brothers did, out of anger for this. Another case was there was a rape of a concubine, and that caused a civil war in Israel, which destroyed the entire tribe of Benjamin, except for a few last people, and that's recorded in the book of Judges. We have the prohibitions of rape that you did quote. We have the prohibition of kidnapping, which relates to this. And finally, we have Leviticus has the golden rule to do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. So I see that. And Jesus and other rabbis, I mean, he's quoting other rabbis, I think Rabbi Shem, I forget who, say that that's one of the authoritative, like, key verses. That's understood at the time.
Yeah, can I jump in on this real quick? Because this is some important evidence, and I think if I could go back, I'd like to. I think I alluded to Deuteronomy 22 and the verses that preclude rape, but I didn't quote it and go into it as much depth as I'd like to. But it actually says in Deuteronomy 22, verses 25 to 27, it says, if in the open country a man meets a young woman who is betrothed, and the man seizes her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. She has committed no offense. And then it goes on to say, for this case is like that of a man attacking and murdering his neighbor, because he met her in the open country, and though the betrothed young woman cried for help, there was no one to rescue her. And I think the fact that it compares it to the case of a man attacking and murdering his neighbor, the idea of seizing the woman and lying with her and having intercourse, that forcible nature of things, Deuteronomy itself acknowledges is like that of a man attacking and murdering. So I think that was a clear condemnation that I would
That's have a great
like to bring up. I will say the Leviticus evidence is interesting. Leviticus 19:18 does say, you know, to love your neighbor as yourself. And that's very clear. I will say one pushback you can make against that, though, is a big question in the Old Covenant and in this time is, well, who is my neighbor? Mm-hmm. And that's actually what prompts Jesus to give the parable of the Good Samaritan. But I will say back in their time, there was debate as to who counted as a neighbor. Now, it's true they have to treat the widower, the orphan, and the sojourner with respect and dignity at all times. But I could see, you know, some Israelite warrior trying to make an argument like, well, yeah, but conquered people, they don't count as my neighbor, so I don't have to love them as myself, even though we know in the New Covenant that Jesus reveals unequivocally, no, every person is your neighbor, and you are to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and person is yourself, and he brings all the Gentiles in, and we have that clear, clear case. But I would say those are two, at the very least, to go back to your original question about the burden of proof, I think the way Deuteronomy 22 describes a rape case, the way Leviticus sets up the law of love, those other cases you pointed to in Genesis and Judges, those kind of lay the groundwork for, well, I like the way you put it, a culture that is not pro-rape, but against rape. It sees it as a clear violation. So if someone's going to then say part of the law actually approves of rape, the burden of proof would be heavy on them.
And let me circle back to what you were saying earlier. Sure. Hang on, train of thought here. Anyways, so what we were just saying earlier was that it hinges on whether or not this is rape. I would say that it's pretty clear that you can't have premarital sex, at which point you would have to be married. But within marriage, is your wife your neighbor? Oh, goodness gracious. Yes, of course, right? Is she under the covenant? Yes, absolutely. That's part of the whole, arguably, the part of the whole shaving of the head, et cetera. She's part of the covenant. So if she went through all of those covenant rituals, which are described in Leviticus, or which are described in Deuteronomy, then she is part of the covenant, at which point she would be your neighbor, at which point you would have to treat her as you would yourself.
That's a great point. So even if somebody were to bring up that rebuttal that I mentioned a few minutes ago, that, well, there's a big question in the Old Testament of who would be my neighbor. Even if they could bring that point up in general, there's no question that if you marry someone that they would count as your neighbor, and especially as a member of the covenant and given all the privileges that other covenant women would be given. Okay.
Exactly. And then and what you were saying earlier about he's claiming, well, it doesn't say that there's consent, but like, hang on, that's like reading Moby Dick and saying, well, it doesn't say here in this particular chapter that there's a whale at all. It's like, well, you do know it's a book, right? So I would kind of say the same thing to him and say, all right, well, great. Well, you do know you're reading a book. So we would have to look outside of this passage if it doesn't say consent or not consent, at which point we got to bring in all the things we were just mentioning, and two more things I would bring in. One is that at very least he would say that Judaism and Christianity condemn any type of rape now. So burden of proof wise, I'm going to ask him, A, where is this enormous change that apparently happened in Judaism that went from allowing rape to unequivocally saying that it's wrong? And then second, does he have any authoritative sources, any authoritative rabbis that support his interpretation of the passage? Because it's not like this is just a Rorschach test where we just all 2,000 years later just kind of take a swing at it. There's an actual tradition that links us back to these covenant people. And if he's outside of that tradition entirely and can't bring to me a rabbi, maybe something from the Talmud, which supports his, then I'm just going to say that was never the intention of the law.
No, those are some strong points. And to be fair to Dana Harper here, I will say he didn't just point to the lack of consent mentioned and say, therefore, she didn't consent. He pointed to the lack of consent mentioned, and then he used the language of the text such that it says you would bring her into your home. You shall shave her head and perineal. She shall take off the clothes she was in, and she shall remain in your house a full month. In other words, describing these rituals as something that she must do, yet without speaking of her consent. That is, so he did get into the textual argument there, but I think you're bringing up a good point. And what I argued is that, well, the text doesn't tell us at the outset of these rituals, there could have been an offer or an understanding. Hey, one of these warriors wants to marry you. You know, would you enter into this or not? And I think that's a really clever point, Jake, to think about the paradigm shift argument. And Jimmy Akin makes a similar argument with respect to sola scriptura in another context. But if you're going to say that the culture went from saying rape is permissive to then changing it and saying, no, it's not, you should be able to point to when this change took place, and particularly in the rabbinic interpretation, how that happened. But I'll leave it to the listeners. I think we've talked a good amount about that important topic, though, of like what the passage actually approves. Is it rape or not? I'll leave it to the listeners to judge it. But I will say, in the end, I don't think he was able to meet the burden of proof on that score.
Agreed. Let me throw one more thing in there. You're right. I'm glad you brought up that point that he did argue from the text itself with the she shall kind of language. The problem I have with that argument is we still need to know the context of the she shall this and that. It sounds to me like similar language with, say, like the Levirate vow, where he shall cut his head, he shall eat this and that, or with the stuff with the priests. He shall be marked on his thumb with the blood, etc. That doesn't imply that everybody needs to be forced into the priesthood, nor does it involve everybody needs to be forced into a Levirate vow. It means that people who end up going into the priesthood or end up taking that vow or end up doing any of these customs will then fulfill those things because there's a proper ordering in order to come into the covenant in this particular way. So I would just throw that pushback because I think it's fair to discuss what he's saying, the shall language, but I don't think that's definitive. I think that it's like what you said. There could have been an offer. There could have been consent. Or I'm going to throw another one into the mix, and that is later on in the passage, it references why there's, I believe it's this one. I did an episode earlier, which I covered this in another passage. I hope I'm not getting them confused. But it's in the context of defeating groups of people who've polluted the land with these certain sins. And we find out elsewhere in the Torah that those sins included human sacrifice. So let's assume that these women were brought into the covenant, just captured, like straight up, worst apologetic scenario. Well, I would say, given that God is an authority, the moral authority, he could delegate to his servants the right to essentially arrest these women who were complicit in or actually doing these specific crimes, bring them into the covenant. I mean, if our governments have the right to arrest people and bring them into a jail, why can't the Israelites, if God is real, assuming the Christian paradigm, bring these people out of these evil situations into a good one and for the purpose of rehabilitation?
I like that you brought up the Christian paradigm because that was another one of the principles I wanted to argue for, was that a lot of this debate and dialogue, and maybe we can get to this now a little bit. I was going to save it for later, but I think it's good, Jake, that you just mentioned that. A lot of this really is going to depend on our previous worldviews. And one of the principles I defended in the debate is our worldview is going to significantly interpret how we interpret the text. And I think what you're doing is being fair to the text. What I'm doing, I think we're being fair to the text. But I'm sure Dana thinks what he's doing is being fair to the text as well. But I will say, as Christians, as Catholic Christians, we're just going to be more inclined to read these things in a favorable light, but also in light of the whole of Scripture. And I think again and again, what you just did there by referring to certain conquered people groups who practiced very immoral things. Now, we don't know if this specific group or this would have applied in the case of all captive women, but it definitely could have applied in the case of some of them. And as long as we as Catholic Christians can find a favorable way to read some of these difficult passages in the Old Testament, then I think we've defended the integrity of sacred Scripture. They're the ones saying, listen, you know, your Bible is immoral and it has these passages that don't make sense. And we're just saying, well, no, we disagree. Here's a way to read them that does make sense and shows why they're not immoral. So I think that was another kind of overall point in the background of the debate.
I like the point that you brought up where with the section of because he humiliated her. And he took that as, oh, this is like a dictate. You should now go and humiliate her. But you turned that around and showed that actually that's calling out his behavior. That's showing that this isn't the ideal, that this is, there's a problem in this situation if he does certain things. And therefore, it's calling this guy out. So I thought that was a really good point.
Yeah, can I situate that in the context of like the principle of mitigation? Did you want to introduce that?
Yes.
I know we wanted to talk about that a little.
Definitely open that one up a bit. Yep.
Okay. So, because what Jake just mentioned about the last verse where it says, but if you no longer delight in her, you shall let her go where she wants. You shall not sell her for money or treat her as a slave, since you have humiliated her. I think that passage really speaks to how I was overall trying to contextualize these captive bride verses as God's willing to work with the Israelites and Old Covenant people where they are to improve upon these harsh conditions, these difficult realities where they are facing, yet to bring them closer and closer to the New Covenant law of love. And what I argued is that sometimes, just as a parent would not give a 3 or a 4 year old an advanced moral code and expect him to follow it because he's not willing yet. He doesn't have the capacities yet. So God, working with the Old Covenant people, the Israelites, as they were just learning his ways and growing up in relationship with him, might not give them the full-fledged Sermon on the Mount right away. Instead, he might take some of the practices and things that they're prone to do already. And instead of allowing them to be, run roughshod and be as immoral and, unwieldy as they might otherwise be, he will choose, instead of just to like cut everything off cold turkey, he might choose to mitigate or to put up boundaries and restrictions around those things so that it's not no holds bars in how you treat people or how you work with this institution. But over time, first I'm going to restrict it. First I'm going to restrain it. And then over time, I'm going to teach you the fuller way of how we relate to one another. And the classic examples, and I talk about this in my book, actually, One Less God Than You, are slavery or servitude, how that's discussed in the Old Testament. There's also polygamy, which Dana Harper did bring up in this debate, and I didn't actually respond to it because there's only so much time. But the issue of polygamy and taking more than one wife, and then I would situate some of the nature of certain warfare and these captive bride verses, amongst other things, which are an instance of, God not saying, he doesn't just go to them and say, when you take slaves, when you take multiple wives, this is the best thing ever. And I hope you keep doing it no matter what, forever, as much as you want, treat them however you want. It doesn't matter. No, the scriptures, they absolutely do not say that. Instead, it's God saying, well, hey, when you do these practices, you got to follow these restrictions. You got to follow these codes that don't just let you do whatever you want, but that are actually putting in what I call in the debate a scaffolding that only lets you do so much. And then eventually, when you grow up in our relationship and we see this law of love with the old law pointed to all along in Jesus Christ, then you can hear the Sermon on the Mount. And then there's absolutely no room for things like slavery, polygamy, as God said, from the beginning, it was not so. Man and woman shall join together and become one flesh. And also, I think the nature of captive brides and other things are covered by this principle of mitigation. And just to cite one authority, which I didn't bring up in the debate, but John Bergsma and Brant Petrie in their introduction to the Old Testament, they actually say Deuteronomy chapters 12 through 26, and that's where this passage is found that we're discussing. They say those passages in particular, and Jesus refers back to these when he talks about divorce in the New Testament, are all speeches of Moses. They're speeches of Moses, but they're not dictated the same way as the speeches of Moses are in Exodus or in other places in Deuteronomy, when they simply say, and the word of the Lord came to Moses, and he spoke the word of the Lord to the people. No, instead, these verses in Deuteronomy 12 through 26, they record Moses' speeches to the people, and we as Catholics hold that they are inspired, but they don't necessarily have, they don't have the same gravitas, as you will, or the same, they have some markers in them that they could be, you know, God's restrictions or restraints or his way of mitigating the evil that Israelites were prone to, even though he wasn't going to eradicate it at that time, but he would eradicate it later when they grew up in their faith. So a lot of the debate centered around this principle of mitigation. And I am curious, Jake, of what you thought about that.
Yeah, I think that definitely needs to be on the table. And there's a couple ways we can look at it. One is law is a teacher. And it takes a while to inculcate certain ideas into a whole people. And the other one is, you often hear the term governments depend on the consent of the governed. And that's taken a variety of ways. But one of them is that when you put out laws, those laws actually require popular assent. Otherwise, it's not that they're illegitimate, but it's that they're ineffective. So if you put forth a law, which is, hey, Israelites, you have to, and you lay out the absolute most amazing thing, a lot of them are just going to say, sorry, too hard, we're out. You have to lay down law in the zone of proximal development. It's just like a kid's kind of learning things. You have to keep something just a little bit ahead, or if you're working out, you need to just have it a little bit heavier than last time. We have to put laws in the zone of proximal moral development in order to make it look like it's something worth having. It needs to be, in the mind of the people hearing the law, an aspirational goal of sorts to say, yeah, I would like to live up to that law. And I think I just about can, even if I fail sometimes. So that would be one point. A, a teacher, and it takes a while to teach. And B, it's got to be in the zone of moral proximal development. The other thing that was brought up by Dana, which I thought was a good point, and I was wondering if you had some more thoughts on it, was he says, kind of to this general argument, well, why did it take 1,000 years? Couldn't they have learned a little quicker? Couldn't he have put a better law there? Like, seriously, like, if there's really this ideal that came around later that, you know, suburban Joe can even live up to today, how come, you know, ancient Israel, you know, Rahim could not live up to it then? Why 1,000 years, John?
Yeah, that was a good point that he made. And I thought it was coupled with his other point that, you know, it sounds like you're arguing that just because the Bible is good, just because the Quran is worse, or let's say some other text that approves some grotesque thing, just because it's a little bit better, therefore it's good. And my response to the debate was twofold. One, I'm not conceding that the text approves of something that's intrinsically immoral. So I don't concede that it approves of rape. I do think it would be – I don't think it would be possible to defend a principle of mitigation if the text was specifically approving of something intrinsically immoral and saying it was a good thing. Agreed. What I'm arguing is that the text doesn't do that. It doesn't it just says, well, hey, you Israelites, you do this kind of thing. You're going to go out to war against people. You're going to see captive, beautiful captive women among them. And you're going to want to, you know, you're going to want to be with them. When that happens, you got to do it my way. You got to do it according to the laws of the God of Israel, which set in place these strict regulations. So I do want to say that first. Second, my point was, the Torah is not the last word. I do think the prophets are often railing against the immorality of Israel itself. And so I think they continue to grow up in their relationship with God, but they get further instruction and they get convicted and they get, you know, really called out by both the major and the minor prophets throughout the Old Testament. And that continues down to the time of Christ. But then, and then my other point was that there's also an oral tradition. And so we, as Catholics, we don't hold the sola scriptura. So the Torah is not just the only word on any issue. We have the preaching of the prophets to bring Israelites closer to a relationship with God and to call them out on any immorality. And we also have oral tradition and oral teaching down until the time of Christ, which in that case, we do get the Sermon on the Mount and the Law of Love. But yeah, I'm curious how you would respond to that, Jake.
Well, I'm just kind of mulling it over now. I guess one thing I'd have to say is the only thing going on back then was not the moral inculcation of things in Israel. It was also the raging immorality in the world. And I think that we got to situate this in the idea that there's God, there's the devil, and there's good and bad people. And it was a very long process because it was interrupted. It was interrupted by immoral nations capturing, by marrying these foreign women who brought in other things, a la Solomon, et cetera, by the people themselves turning to idols. So I'd say that it's not a fault of the law. The law is God's holy word. David meditates on it day and night. But the problem is that it's a difficult and stiff-necked people. And this is prior to the grace that was given through Christ. And after that, well, then through baptism, the sacraments, and through the earth-shaking sacrifice of Jesus, grace is actually available such that a higher moral level can be achieved. And interestingly, I think that that's just empirically verified when we look at the history of humanity. You know, I have it's been a while, but I had a podcast episode called The Messianic Age Isn't a Disappointment. And I really should remake it because I need to put some more study in it. But a lot of the things that were pointed to by the rabbis, hinted at by the prophets, totally happened. It did not disappoint. We're in a pretty amazing age. And I chalk that up to the life, death, and resurrection of Christ.
No, that's powerful, important stuff there. I want to add too that one of the things I really appreciated about this debate and Dana pressing these points is, it like you just mentioned, it gave us an invitation to research some of these ideas further. And I know one of the things that I'd want to do in order to strengthen my argument on behalf of this principle of mitigation, I want to get some comparisons going. I would like to know, okay, Deuteronomy is Moses' speeches. At least that's what I think is what the evidence shows and what we as Catholic Christians take them to be, even if some people say they were, you know, let's say put together by an editor a little bit later on. They're definitely purporting to record the speeches of Moses. And so when Moses was giving these speeches and describing these restrictions on what Israelite warriors were to do with captive women, do we have evidence of how other cultures treated captive women? And can we do a little bit of comparison? And this is something, because, you know, it's not my area as far as being an Old Testament scholar that I even would know exactly the sources immediately to look at. But I am curious, and something I'd like to dive into further. And I know it's done with respect to servitude and in the issue of slavery. And I know Dr. Paul Copan has done a lot of discussion on that, and his book is God a Moral Monster, and he's got a new one out from a few years ago with respect to slavery. But I am curious if any other cultures or old sources speak about how do you deal with this issue of captive women. Do they have the same kind of regulations around polygamy that we find in the Old Testament? We don't find necessarily one single zinger verse that says you shall never take another wife, though some people argue that Leviticus 18:18 could be there. Jesus tells us that in the beginning, it was not so that a man and woman could divorce. One man, one woman were to be together as a permanent bond in this life. But how were other cultures talking about these things of captive women, of the issue of multiple wives, and how does the Torah and Moses' speeches measure up to that? I mean, my Christian instinct is that according to this principle of mitigation, I think the Israelite laws are going to look pretty good, but I would like to do some of that research and get more of that on the table.
Absolutely. Well, I know we got to start wrapping things up, John. So let's kind of see if we can brainstorm or list out a few things that our listeners could look into. That is one of them. And if anybody's listening that knows something about that, write into me or John. and let us know. So that's one. How does it compare to other laws of the time? I think that's great. I think it's going to compare extraordinarily favorably. And I think that even our atheist friend here was coming at this passage with deep Christian instincts. It was shaped by a Christian culture and from a Christian nation. And ironically, he's using those Christian instincts in order to go into the passage and to claim that it was unchristian in what he was pushing out. So that's one. The other is, and I got this one hopefully covered, talking to good old John Bergsma about Hebrew marriages in general and how consent was part of it, how this whole thing played out. Because I think that's going to illuminate the passage, because clearly there's marriage as part of the captive bride whole situation. So we have to have that on the table.
Yes. And actually, just to piggyback on that real quick, and I want you to continue that list. I would like to know, and if you're able to interview Dr. Bergsma on this, that's great. But I have a feeling, my hunch is, these Deuteronomy 21 verses 10 to 14 passages would involve whatever the normal kind of consent, however it was carried out, that was typical in Israelite marriages when it wasn't a case of captive women or conquered peoples. I would hold that whatever kind of consent was going on in the regular case would also be applicable here. But I'm curious of his opinion as a scholar and what he can point to back that up. Because like I said, I'm not an Old Testament scholar. I've not done a super, super deep dive into all of the facets of how Israelites viewed marriage. But that's a great point to look into further.
All right. Well, what other points can you think of that people could dive into? What do you wish you could have got into more or opened up more, researched more?
Yeah, I guess one thing I always think about is, how important are these debates on Old Testament difficulties? Should we really be doing them? Should we really instead focus on the big issues of why believe in God, why follow Jesus, why belong to the Catholic Church? Should we spend the bulk of our energy on those big questions and not worry so much about these? My instinct on that is mixed. Personally, I think these passages are a big sticking point for certain people who are exposed to them. So I think it might have to be a case-by-case basis, but that's something I'd like to think about more, is how important is it to debate these Old Testament difficulties when instead we could be debating God's existence, Jesus as Messiah, and the resurrection, and why we hold that the Catholic Church is the church that he founded. Is more better energy spent there, or, you know, was this a worthwhile dialogue to have? Another thing I'd like to do in a future dialogue on this issue, which I didn't do, but I think I want to ask as a question, if we're going to argue a principle of mitigation, I want to ask at least my dialogue partner, where do they stand on that particular principle? In other words, are they denying that God could ever use such a principle? Or instead, are they denying, or are they saying that he sometimes could use such a principle, but in this case, he couldn't? Or are they denying that the text could even plausibly be read as God using a principle of mitigation? That is kind of a three-prong. I think they could do one of those three things, but I actually don't know where Dana Harper stands on that, because I didn't ask him. So I think one of the things we have to do, if we're using a principle of mitigation to explain things like slavery, polygamy, these captive women verses, and so forth, let's ask our dialogue partner, how do they view that principle? Are you saying the text can't possibly be using it? Are you saying that God can't legitimately use it himself? And then they got to explain why. Or are they saying, well, he could do it in some cases, but he can't do it in this case for some certain reason? And I actually don't know where exactly he falls on this. My instinct is maybe on the last one, maybe he would say he can't use it at all, because in this case, the passage condones rape. But we've already said in the beginning, well, we don't think that's the case. So those are a couple further things I'm still thinking about.
Awesome. Yeah. I don't know if you probably haven't, but I had a podcast episode a while ago that was saying, I think it's called Stretch Forth Your Hand, when reaching for God breaks one of God's laws. And it examines some difficult cases in scripture where it appears that a moral figure broke a law and yet is deemed righteous, and how exactly you deal with that. I think that actually might come to bear on this particular situation, where my overall approach was looking at the hierarchy of goods itself and saying that the law is a tool to help us arrange properly the hierarchy of goods. And there's times when we're putting a higher good above a lower good, and it could break some type of law in some way. I mean, there's a lot of nuance. You shouldn't break the laws. But this is kind of, I don't know if this would maybe help, because it seems like that's what we're doing here. We're doing something we don't necessarily want to do. We might even be bringing somebody against their will into Israel. I tend to think there is probably consent, but like, let's say there wasn't. Can we justify that, not in a utilitarian way, but in a way that says, hey, this this person is brought from this terrible situation, both morally, physically, economically, into this good situation under divine authority for the purpose of eventually, ultimately, arranging the hierarchy of goods in the most important way, in that they're joining into the worship of Israel, of the one true God. Like, there seems to be those sticky situations that are really difficult to deal with, where it seems like something bad is happening, and yet it's for some greater good. It's not an endorsement of utilitarianism, but it is something that God seems to somehow providentially order. I know I opened up a can of worms there.
I'm just going to say, Jake Buscher, you always have a ton of interesting thoughts, and the debates are, as Trent Horn likes to say, they're not really the final word on a topic, but they're an invitation to investigate more. So I do hope when to listen to that episode of yours that you're mentioning, and also just continue to learn a little bit more myself about this issue so I can put forth the Catholic Christian case in the strongest way. But thank you so much. I just see on the monitor here, my daughter is getting up from her nap, so I do have to run shortly, but thank you so much for having me on for this debrief.
But John, thanks so much for getting out there and debating. I really mean it when I think you did a really great job. I think you opened up some incredible things for discussion. I think anybody who listens to that is going to be edified. And I love the work you're doing, so keep it up. And great. Well, let's wrap it up now. And let's see if you want to close it out with anything else you got to say, or we can just wrap it up right.
Yeah, here. I'll just say if listeners want to hear it again or hear more of our podcast episodes defending Catholic Christian ideas, you can head over to classicaltheism.com/episodes and see all the topics we've discussed. But thanks again, Jake, for having me on for this debrief and for, you know, helping me out a little bit behind the scenes in preparation for this debate and discussing it afterwards. I really value your opinion and your content as well. So thanks again.
All right. Great. Thanks, John. God bless.